that either. I was what they called trouble. Capital T. Envious boys routinely took swings. Girls slapped. School spit me out like a bad oyster. To my father, I was the traitor. To his name and his plans for me, study abroad, law school, practice at his firm, follow his footsteps, his life. Instead, I lived mine. Pomona College for 2 years. Studied broads. Dropped out in 1960 to be in pictures. A bad complexion shot pox in my plans. So I decided to learn the biz from inside. Starting at the bottom. A job in publicity at 20th Century Fox. We worked in the old Fox car barn next to the greasy Teamsters. Talked on the phone all day to reporters and gossip columnists. We tried to get good stories in the papers and keep bad ones out. At night, I went to openings and parties and benefits. Did I love it? Who wouldn't? A different lady on my arm every night. The sun and the strip and the sex. Life was electric. My boss was a fat, jug-eared Midwesterner named Dooley. He kept me close because I was fresh. Because I threatened him. But one morning Dooley wasn't in the office. A frantic call came in. Some sharp was at the studio gate with some interesting photos. A well-known cowboy actor at a party. One of our rising stars. What wasn't so well-known was that this fellow was also a first-class poof. And these pictures showed him blowing on another fella's bugle. Most animated performance this particular actor ever gave. Dooley would be in the next day, but this couldn't wait. First, I reached out to a gossip columnist who owed me. Planted the rumor that the cowboy actor was engaged to a young actress, a rising B-girl. How did I know she'd go for it? She was a girl I'd beefed a few times myself. Having her name connected to a bigger star was the fastest way to the front of the skinnies. Sure, she went for it. In this town, everything flows upstream. Then I strolled to the gate and casually hired the photographer to shoot promo stills for the studio. Burned the negs of the cowboy Hummer myself. I got the call at noon. Had it taken care of by 5. But the next day, Dooley was furious. Why? Because Skouros had called. And the head of the studio wanted to see me, not him. Dooley prepped me for an hour. Don't look old Skouros in the eye. Don't use profanity, and whatever you do, never disagree with the man. Fine. I waited outside Skouros's office an hour, then I stepped inside. He was perched on the corner of his desk, wore a funeral director's suit. A thick man with black glasses and slick hair. He gestured to a chair, offered me a Coca-Cola. Thank you. The tight Greek bastard opened the bottle. He poured a third of it into a glass and handed me the glass. He held the rest of that Coke like I hadn't earned it yet. He sat there on the corner of that desk and watched me drink my tiny Coke while he asked me questions. Where was I from? What did I hope to do? What was my favorite picture? He never even mentioned the cowboy star. And what does this big studio boss want from the dean? Michael, tell me. What do you know about Cleopatra? Stupid question. Every last person in town knew every last thing about that film. Mostly how it was eating Fox alive. How the idea had kicked around for 20 years before Walter Wanger developed it in 58. But then Wanger caught his wife blowing her agent, and he shot the agent in the balls. So Reuben Mamoulian took over Cleo. Budgeted the thing for $2 million with Joan Collins. Who made as much sense as Don Knotts. So the studio dumped her and went after Liz Taylor. The biggest star in the world, but she was reeling from bad publicity after she stole Eddie Fisher from Debbie Reynolds. Not even 30, and already on her 4th marriage. At this precarious stage of her career, and what's she do? Demands $1 million and 10% of Cleopatra. No one had ever made half a mil on a picture. And this dame wants a mill? But the studio was desperate. Skouros said yes. Mamoulian took 40 people to England to start production on Cleo in 1960. It was hell right off. Bad weather, bad luck, sets built, sets torn down, sets rebuilt, Mamoulian couldn't shoot a single frame. Liz got sick. A cold became an abscessed tooth, became a brain infection, became a staph infection, became pneumonia. Woman had a tracheotomy and nearly died on the table. Cast and crew sat around drinking and playing cribbage. After 16 months of production and $7 million, he had less than 6 feet of usable film. A year and a half, and the man hadn't even shot his height in film. Skouros had no choice. He fired Mamoulian, brought in Joe Mankiewicz. Mankey moved the whole thing to Italy and dumped the whole cast except Liz, brought in Dick Burton to be Mark Antony, hired 50 screenwriters to fix the script. Soon it was 500 pages, 9 hours of story. The studio was losing $70,000 a day while 1,000 extras sat around getting paid for nothing. And it rained and rained and people walked off with cameras. And Liz drank and Mankey started talking about making it into 3 pictures. The studio was in so deep by now there was no turning back. Not after 2 years of production and $20 million already down the shitter. And God knows how much more while poor tight Skouros rode that goddamn thing all the way down, hoping against hope that what showed up on screen was the greatest goddamn movie spectacle ever made. What do I know about Cleopatra? I looked up at Skouros perched on his desk holding the rest of my cola. Guess I know a little. Right answer. Skouros poured some more coke in my glass. Then he reached over to his desk, grabbed a manila envelope, handed it to me. I will never forget the photo I pulled out of that envelope. It was a work of art. 2 people in tight clench. And not any 2 people. Dick Burton and Liz Taylor. Not Antony and Cleopatra in a publicity shot. Liz and Dick, lip-locked on a patio at the Grand Hotel in Rome. Tongues spelunking each other's mouths. This was disaster. They were both married. The studio was still dealing with the shit publicity from Liz breaking up the marriage of Debbie and Eddie. Now Liz is getting beefed by the greatest stage actor of his generation? And a top-notch coxman to boot? What about Eddie Fisher's little kids? And Burton's family? His poor Welsh rotters with their coal-stained eyes crying about their lost daddy? The pub would kill the movie. Kill the studio. The movie's budget was already a guillotine hanging over Skouros' fat Greek head. This would drop the blade. I stared at the photo. Skouros did his best to smile and look calm, but his eyes blinked like a metronome. What do you think, Dean? What did Dean think? Not so fast. There was something else I knew, but I didn't really know yet. See? The way you know about sex before you really know about it. I had a gift, but I hadn't figured how to use it. Sometimes I could see through people, right to their cores, like an X-ray. Not a human lie detector, a desire detector. It's what got me in trouble, too. A girl tells me no. Why? She's got a boyfriend. I hear no, but I see yes. 10 minutes later, the boyfriend walks in to find his girlfriend with a mouthful of Dean. See? It was like that with Skouros. He was saying one thing, but I was seeing something else. So, what now, Dean? Your whole career is in front of you, and Dooley's advice is still playing in your head. Don't look him in the eye. Don't use profanity. Don't challenge him. He says it again. So, what do you think? Deep breath. Well, it looks to me like you're not the only one getting fucked on this picture. Skouros stared at me. Then he straightened up from the corner of his desk. He walked around and sat down. From that moment on, he spoke to me like a man. No more quarter cokes. The old man broke it down. Liz, impossible to deal with. Emotional, stubborn, contrary. But Burton was a pro. And this wasn't his first piece of primo tale. Our only chance was to reason with him, when he was sober. Good luck with that. Your first assignment is to go to Rome and convince a sober Dick Burton that if he doesn't lay off Liz Taylor, he's out of the picture. Right. I flew out the next day. In Rome, I saw right away it wouldn't be easy. This wasn't some on-set affair. They were in love. Even that old actress Dipper Burton was in deep with this one. First time in his life he isn't slopping extras and hairdressers, too. At the Grand Hotel, I laid it out for him. Gave him Skouros' whole message, played it stern. Dick just laughed at me. I'd kick him off the film? Not likely. 36 hours into the biggest assignment of my life, and my bluff's been called. An A-bomb couldn't keep Dick and Liz apart. And no wonder. This was the greatest Hollywood romance in history. Not just some set screw. Love. All those cute couples now with their conjoined names, pale imitations, mere children. Dick and Liz were gods. Pure talent and charisma, and like gods they were terrible together. Awful. A gorgeous nightmare. Drunk and narcissistic and cruel to everyone around them. If only the movie had the drama of these two. They'd film a scene as flat as paper, and as soon as the cameras cut, Burton would make some wry comment, and she'd hiss something back, and she'd storm off, and he'd chase her back to the hotel, and the hotel staff would report these ungodly sounds of breaking glass and yelling and bawling, and you couldn't tell the fighting from the fucking with those two. Empty booze decanters flying over hotel balconies. Every day a car wreck, a 10-car pileup. And that's when it came to me. I call it the moment of my birth. Saints call it epiphany. Billionaires call it brainstorm. Artists call it muse. For me, it was when I understood what separated me from other people. A thing I'd always been able to see but never entirely understood. Divination of true nature, of motivation, of desirous hearts. I saw the whole world in a flash, and I recognized it at once. We want what we want. Dick wanted Liz, Liz wanted Dick, and we want car wrecks. We say we don't, but we love them. To look is to love. 1,000 people drive past the Statue of David. 200 look. 1,000 people drive past a car wreck. 1,000 look. I suppose it is cliche now. Obvious to the computer gee-gaw counters with their hits and eyeballs and page views. But this was a transformational moment for me. For the town. For the world. I called Skouros in L.A. This can't be fixed. The old man was quiet. Are you telling me I need to send someone else? No. I was talking to a 5-year-old. I'm saying this can't be fixed, and you don't want to fix it. He fumed. This wasn't someone used to getting bad news. What the fuck are you talking about? How much do you have into this picture? The actual cost of a film isn't how much. 15. You have 20 in it if you have a dime. Conservatively, you'll spend 25 or 30 before it's done. And how much will you spend on publicity to recoup 30 mil? Skouros couldn't even say the number. Commercials and billboards and ads in every magazine in the world. 8? Let's say 10. Now you're up to 40 mil. No picture in history has ever made 40. And let's be clear, this picture's no good. I've had crabs more enjoyable than this picture. This picture gives shit a bad name. Was I killing Skouros? You bet I was. Only to save him. But what if I could get you 20 million in free publicity? That's not the kind of publicity we want. Maybe it is. Then I explained what it was like on set. The drinking, fighting, sex. When the cameras ran, it was death. But with the cameras off, you couldn't take your eyes off them. Mark Antony and Cleo fucking Patra? Who gave a shit about those old moldered bones? But Liz and Dick? This is our movie! I told Skouros that as long as this thing rages between them, the movie's got a chance. Put this fire out? Hell no. What we need to do is stoke it. It's easy to see now. In this world of fall and redemption and fall again, of comeback after comeback, of carefully released home sex tapes. But no one had thought this way before. Not about movie stars. These were Greek gods, perfect beings. When one of them fell, it was forever. Fatty Arbuckle? Dead. Ava Gardner? Done. I was suggesting burning the whole town down to save this one house. If I pulled this off, people would see our picture not in spite of the scandal, but because of it. After this, you could never go back. Gods would be dead forever. I could hear Skouros breathing on the other end of the phone. Do it. Then he hung up. That afternoon, I bribed Liz's driver. When she and Burton came out to the patio of the villa they'd rented to hide out in, camera shutters started popping from balconies in three directions. Photographers eyed tipped. Next day, I hired my own shooter to stalk the couple. Made tens of thousands selling those photos. Used that money to bribe more drivers and makeup people for information. I had my own little industry. Liz and Dick were furious. They begged me to find out who was leaking information, and I pretended to find out. I fired drivers and extras and caterers, and soon Dick and Liz were relying on me to book their remote getaways, and still the photographers found them. And did it work? It broke bigger than any movie story you've ever seen. Liz and Dick in every newspaper in the world. Dick's wife found out, and Liz's husband. The story got even bigger. I told Skouros to have patience, to ride it out. Then poor Eddie Fisher flew to Rome to try to win his wife back, and suddenly I had a new problem. For this to work, Liz and Dick had to be together when the film wrapped. When the picture opened on Sunset, I needed Dick to be boning Liz in the dining room of the Chateau Marmont, and I needed Eddie Fisher to go limping away. But the son of a bitch wanted to fight for his doomed marriage. The other problem with Liz's husband being in Rome was Burton. He sulked, drank, and he went back to this other woman he'd been seeing on the side off and on since his first day in Italy. She was tall and blonde, uncommon-looking girl. Camera loved her. All the actresses then were either coupes or sedans, broads or girls next door. But this was something else, something new. She had no film experience, came from the stage. Mankey inexplicably cast her as Cleopatra's lady-in-waiting from nothing more than a casting photo. Figured he'd make Liz look more Egyptian by making one of her slaves blonde. Little did he know one of Liz's ladies-in-waiting was actually waiting for Dick. Christ, I couldn't believe it when I saw her. Who puts a tall blonde woman in a movie set in ancient Egypt? I'll call this girl D. This D was what we'd later call a free spirit. One of those moon-eyed, easygoing hippie girls I'd get so much joy out of in the 60s and 70s. Not that I ever beefed this particular one. Not that I wouldn't have. But with Eddie Fisher skulking around Rome, Dick went running to his backup. This D. I didn't figure her to be a problem. Girl like that, you just throw a bone, a cherry roll, a studio contract, and if she won't play, you fire her. What's the cost? So I had Mankiewicz start giving her 5 a.m. calls to get her on set, get her away from Burton. But then she got sick. We had an American doctor on set, this man Crane. His whole job was to prescribe meds for Liz. He examined this girl D, pulled me aside the next day. We got a problem. The girl is pregnant. Doesn't know it yet. Some quack doc told her she can't have kids. Well, she can. Of course, I'd arranged abortions before. I worked in publicity. It was practically on the business card. But this was Italy. Catholic Italy, 1962. At that time, it would have been easier to get a moon rock. Shit. Here I'm leaking that the two biggest stars and the biggest picture in the world are together, and I've got to deal with this? Disaster Dean. If Cleopatra comes out and everyone's talking about our star's torrid affair, we got a chance. If they're talking about Burton knocking up some extra and Liz going back to her husband, we're dead. I put together a 3-part plan. First, get rid of Burton for a while. I knew Dickie Zanuck was in France filming The Longest Day, and I knew he wanted Burton for a cameo to class up his war picture. I knew Burton wanted to do it, but Skouros hated Dick Zanuck. He'd replaced Zanuck's old man at Fox, and there were people on the Fox board who wanted to replace him with dashing young Dickie. So I went behind Skouros' back. I called Zanuck and rented him Burton for 10 days. Then I called the doctor and told him to bring this girl Dee in for more tests. "What kind of tests?" he said. "You're the goddamn doctor, whatever might get her out of town for a while." I was afraid he'd be squirrely, Hippocratic Oath and all that. But this crane jumped at the chance. Next day he comes up with a big smile. "I told her she had stomach cancer." "You what?" Crane explained that the early symptoms of pregnancy were consistent with those of stomach cancer, cramps and nausea and a bunged-up period. I'd wanted to get rid of her, not kill the poor girl. Doc said not to worry. He told her it was treatable. A Swiss doctor with a new procedure. Then he winked. Of course, the doctor in Switzerland puts her under, gives her the short procedure, and when she wakes up, her cancer is gone. She's never the wiser. We send her back to the States to recuperate, and I get her work and some pictures back home. Everyone wins. Problem solved, movie saved. But this Dee was a wild card. Her mother had died of cancer, and she took the phony diagnosis worse than bad, and I underestimated Dick's feelings for her. On the other front, Eddie Fisher had given up and gone home. I called Dick in France to tell him the good news. Liz was ready to see him again, but he couldn't see Liz right now. This other girl, Dee, had cancer. She was dying, and Dick wanted to be there for her. "She'll be fine. There's a doctor in Switzerland who..." Dick interrupted me. This Dee didn't want treatment. She wanted to spend the last of her time with him. And the man was narcissistic enough to think this was a good idea. He's got a 2-day break on The Longest Day, and he wants to meet Dee on the coast in Italy. And since I was so helpful with him and Liz, he wants me to set it up. What could I do? Burton wants to meet her in this remote little coastal town, Porto Venere, right between Rome and the south of France where he's shooting The Longest Day. I opened the map and my eye went straight to this flea speck with a similar name, Porto Vergogna. I asked the travel agent to look into it. She says the town is nothing. Cliffside fishing village. No phones or roads. Can't even get there by train or car. Only by boat. "Is there a hotel?" I asked. Travel agent said there was a tiny one. So I booked a room in Porto Venere for Dick, but I sent Dee to Porto Vergogna. Told her to wait at the little hotel for Burton. I just needed to stow her for a few days until Dick went back to France and I could get her to Switzerland. At first it worked. She was stuck in this village. No contact with the world. Burton showed up in Porto Venere and found me waiting for him instead. I told him Dee had decided to go on to Switzerland for treatment. "Don't worry about her. The Swiss doctors are the best." Then I drove him back to Rome to be with Liz. But before I could get them back together, another problem arrived. Some kid from the hotel where Dee is staying shows up in Rome and walks right up and punches me. I'd been in Rome 3 weeks and I'd gotten used to these Italians gouging me, so I gave him some cash and sent him away. But he double-crossed me, found Burton, and told him the whole story, how Dee wasn't dying, how she was pregnant. Then he took Burton back to her. Great. Now Dick is holed up with his pregnant mistress in a hotel in Porto Venere, and my movie hangs in the balance. But did the Dean give up? Not by a long stretch. I called Dicky Zanuck and got Burton back to France for a day of phony reshoots on The Longest Day. And I raced to Porto Venere to talk to this D. I've never seen someone so angry. She wanted to kill me, and I understood why. I did. I apologized, explained that I had no idea the doctor would say it was cancer. Told her the whole thing had gotten out of hand. Told her that her career was made. Guaranteed. All she had to do was go to Switzerland, and she could be in any Fox picture she wanted. But this was one tough nut. She didn't want money or acting jobs. I couldn't believe it. I'd never met a young actor who didn't want either work or money or both. This was when I understood the deep responsibility behind my ability to divine desire. It's one thing to know what people truly want. It's another to create that want in them, to build that desire. I pretended to sigh. Look, this got out of hand. All he wants is for you to get the abortion and stay quiet about it. So you tell me how we can do that. She flinched. What do you mean, all he wants? I didn't blink. He feels really bad, obviously. He couldn't even ask you himself. That's why he left today. He feels awful about how this all turned out. She looked more hurt than when she'd thought she actually had cancer. Wait, you don't mean... Her eyes closed slowly. It had never occurred to her that Dick might have known all along what I was doing. And frankly, it hadn't occurred to me until that moment either. But in a way, it was true. I acted like I'd assumed she'd known I was acting on his behalf. It was a rush play. I had just a day before Dick got back from France. I had to appear to be defending him. I said he cared deeply for her. That what he was offering didn't change that. I said she shouldn't blame him, that his feelings for her were genuine. But he and Liz were under tremendous pressure with this picture. She interrupted me. She was putting it together. It had been Liz's doctor who diagnosed her. She covered her mouth. Liz knows about this too? I sighed and reached out for her hand. But she recoiled like my hand was a snake. I told her there were no reshoots in France. I said Dick had left a ticket to Switzerland in her name at the La Spezia train station. She looked like she might vomit. I gave her my business card. She took it. I told her that back in the States we'd go over the slate of upcoming Fox films. She could pick any part she wanted. The next morning I drove her to the train station. She got out with her bags, her arms slack at her side. She stood and stared at the station and the green hills behind it. And then she began walking. I watched her disappear inside, and I was never sure of anything. She'd go to Switzerland. Then she'd show up in my office in 2 months, 6 at the most, a year. But she'd come to collect. They all do. But it never happened. She never went to Switzerland, never came to see me. That morning, Burton arrived back from France to see Dee, but found me waiting for him instead. Dick was mad as hell. We went to the train station in La Spezia, but the agent said she'd only come inside and dropped off her luggage. Then she'd turned around and started walking back toward the hills. Dick and I drove back to Porto Venere, but she wasn't there. Dick even made me get a boat to go back to the little fishing town where I'd hid her for a while. But she wasn't there either. She had disappeared. We were about to leave the fishing village when the strangest thing happened. This old witch came down from the hills, cursing and yelling. Our driver translated, "Murderer!" and "I curse you to death!" I looked over at Burton. That old witch really gave it to him. Years later, I'd think about that witch's curse as I watched poor Dick Burton drink himself under. In the boat that day, he was visibly spooked. It was the perfect time for my come-to-Jesus talk with him. "Come on, Dick. What were you going to do? Have a kid with her? Marry that girl? Fuck off, Dean. I could hear it in his voice. He knew I was right. This picture needs you. Liz needs you. He just stared at the sea. Of course I was right. Liz was the one. They were in love like that. I knew, he knew, and I made it all possible. I had done exactly what he wanted me to do, even if he hadn't known it yet. This was what people like me did for people like him. From now on, this would be my place in the world, to divine desire and do the things that other people wanted done, the things they didn't even know they wanted yet, the things they could never do themselves, the things they could never admit to themselves. Dick stared straight ahead in the boat. Did he and I stay friends? Yep. Go to each other's weddings? You bet we did. Did the dean bow his head at the great actor's funeral? Sure I did. And neither of us ever spoke again about what happened in Italy that spring. Not about the girl, not about the village, not about the witch's curse. That was that. Back in Rome, Dick and Liz rekindled, got married, made movies, won awards. You know the story. One of the great romances in the world. A romance I built. And the movie? It came out. And just like I thought, we lived on the publicity of those two. People think Cleopatra was a flop. No. That picture broke even. Broke even because of what I did. Without me, it loses 20 million. Any jackass can make a hit film. It takes giant balls to defuse a bomb. This was the dean's very first assignment, his very first film. And what does he do? Nothing less than keep an entire studio from going under. Nothing less than burn down the old studio system to build a new one. And when Dickie Zanuck took over Fox that summer, you can bet I was rewarded for it. No more car barn for me. No more publicity. But my true reward wasn't the production job I got from my pal Zanuck. My true reward wasn't the fame and money about to come my way. The women and the coke and any table I wanted at any restaurant in town. My reward was a vision that would define my career. We want what we want. And that is how I came to be born a second time. How I came into the world and changed it forever. How in the year 1962 on the coast of Italy, I invented celebrity. Editor's note. Some story, Michael. Unfortunately, even if we wanted to use this chapter, legal has some fundamental issues with it, which our attorneys will address in a separate correspondence. Editorially, though, there's one other thing you should know. This chapter does not paint you in a very good light. Admitting you broke up two marriages and faked a young woman's illness and bribed her to get an abortion, all in the first chapter, may not be the best way to introduce you to readers. And even if the lawyers would let us use this anecdote, it's terribly incomplete. So much is left hanging. What happened to the young actress? Did she get the abortion? Did she have Burton's baby? Did she go on acting? Is she someone famous? That would be cool. Did you try to make it up to her somehow? Track her down? Get her some great film role? Did you at least learn a lesson or have some regret? You see where I'm going? Look, it's your life, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. But this story really needs closure. Some idea of what happened to the girl. Some sense that you at least tried to do the right thing. Chapter 16. After the Fall. September 1967. Seattle, Washington. A dark stage. The sound of waves. Then appears Maggie, in a rumpled wrap, bottle in her hand, her hair in snags over her face, staggering out to the edge of the pier and standing in the sound of the surf. Now she starts to topple over the edge of the pier when Quentin rushes out of the cottage and takes her in his arms. She slowly turns around and they embrace. Soft jazz is heard from within the cottage. Maggie. You were loved, Quentin. No man was ever loved like you. Quentin, releasing her. My plane couldn't take off all day. Maggie, drunk but aware. I was going to kill myself just now. Or don't you believe that either? Wait, wait, wait. On stage, Deborah Bender's shoulders slumped as the director rose from the first row. Black-rimmed glasses at the end of his nose, pencil behind his ear, script in hand. Dee, sweetheart, what happened? She looked down into the front row. What's the matter now, Ron? I thought we agreed you were going to take it further, make it bigger. She made quick eye contact with the other actor on stage, Aaron, who sighed and cleared his throat. I like the way she's doing it, Ron. He put his hands out to Deborah. There, that's all I can do. But Ron ignored the other actor as he strode to the end of the stage and climbed the stairs. He stalked purposefully between the actors and put his hand in the small of Deborah's back, as if leading her in dancing. Dee, we've only got 10 days before we open. I don't want your performance to get lost because it's too subtle. Yeah, I don't think subtlety's the problem, Ron. She twisted gently away from his hand. If Maggie starts out as a lunatic, there's no place for the scene to go. She's trying to kill herself, Dee. She is a lunatic. Right, it's just she's a drunk, a pill popper, a user of men. No, I know, but... Ron's hand worked slowly down her back. The man was nothing if not consistent. This is a flashback in which we see that Quentin did everything he could do to keep her from killing herself. Yeah. Deborah shot another look over Ron's shoulder at Aaron, who was miming masturbation. Ron stepped even closer in a cloud of aftershave. Maggie has sucked the life out of Quentin, Dee. She's killing both of them. Over Ron's shoulder, Aaron air-humped a pretend partner. Uh-huh, Deborah said. Maybe we could talk in private for a second, Ron. His hand pressed even farther down. I think that's a great idea. They stepped off stage and walked up the aisle, Deborah sliding into a wood-backed theater seat. Rather than sitting next to her, Ron wedged in between her and the seat back in front of her, so that their legs were touching. Christ, did this man secrete aqua velva? What's the matter, sweetheart? What's the matter? She almost laughed. Where to start? Maybe it was agreeing to be in a play about Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe, directed by the married man she'd stupidly slept with 6 years ago and then bumped into at a Seattle Rep fundraiser. Or maybe, now that she thought about it, that was her first mistake, going to an event she should have known better than to attend. In her first few years back in Seattle, she had avoided the old theater crowd, not wanting to explain either her child or how her film career had died. Then she saw an ad for the fundraiser in the PI, and she admitted to herself how much she missed it. She walked into the party feeling that warm glow of familiarity, like walking the halls of your old high school. And then she saw Ron, fondue fork in his hand, like a tiny devil. Ron had flourished in the local theater scene in the years since she'd been gone, and she was genuinely glad to see him. But he looked at Deborah, and then at the older man with her. She introduced them. Ron, this is my husband, Alvis. And he immediately went pale and left the party. It just seems like you're taking this play sort of personally, Deborah said. This play is personal, Ron said seriously. He removed his glasses and chewed on the arm. All plays are personal, Dee. All art is personal. Otherwise, what's the point? This is the most personal thing I've ever done. Ron had called 2 weeks after the fundraiser and apologized for leaving. He said he just hadn't been prepared to see her. He asked what she was doing now. She was a housewife, she said. Her husband owned a Chevrolet dealership in Seattle, and she was at home raising their little boy. Ron asked if she missed acting and she muttered some inanity about how it was nice to take some time off. But Deborah thought to herself, I miss it the way I miss love. I'm half a person without it. A few weeks later, Ron called to say that the rep was doing an Arthur Miller play and that he was directing it. Would she be interested in reading for one of the leads? She felt breathless, dizzy, 20 again. But honestly, she probably would have said no, if not for the movie she'd just seen. Dick and Liz's latest film, The Taming of the Shrew, of all things. It was their fifth movie together, and while Deborah hadn't been able to bring herself to see the earlier ones, last year both Burton and Taylor had been nominated for Oscars for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and she'd started to wonder if she'd been wrong about Dick throwing away his talent. Then she saw an advertisement for The Taming of the Shrew in a magazine. The world's most celebrated movie couple, in the film they were made for. And she got a babysitter, said she had a doctor's appointment, and went to a matinee without telling Alvis. And as much as she hated to admit it, the film was marvelous. Dick was wonderful in it, artful and honest, playing drunk Petruchio in the wedding scene as if he were born for the part, which, of course, he was. All of it, Shakespeare, Liz, Dick, Italy, fell on her like an early death, and she mourned the loss of her younger self, of her dreams. And in the movie theater that day, she wept. You gave all that up, a voice said. No, she thought. They took it from me. She sat there until the credits were done and the lights came up, and still she sat there alone. 2 weeks later, Ron called to offer her the play. Deborah hung up the phone and found herself weeping again. Pat, setting down his tinker toys to ask, What's the matter, Mama? And that night, when Alvis got home from work and they had their pre-dinner martinis, Deborah told Alvis about the phone call. He was thrilled for her. He knew how much she missed acting. She played devil's advocate. What about Pat? Alvis shrugged. They'd hire a sitter. But maybe this wasn't a good time. Alvis just scoffed. There was one more thing, Deborah explained. The director was a man named Ron Fry, and before she'd left for Hollywood, and eventually Italy, she'd had a short, stupid affair with him. There was no great passion behind it, she said. She was motivated almost entirely by boredom, or maybe just by his attraction to her. And Ron was married at the time. Ah, Alvis said. But there's nothing between us, she assured Alvis. That was her younger self, the one who believed that if she simply ignored rules and conventions, like marriage, they would have no power over her. She felt no connection to that younger self. Strong, secure Alvis shrugged off her history with Ron and told her to go for the part. So she did, and she got it. But once rehearsals started, Deborah realized Ron had made a connection between himself and Miller's protagonist, Quentin. In fact, he saw himself as Arthur Miller, the genius waylaid by a shallow young villainous actress, the shallow young villainous actress being, of course, her. In the theater, Dee swung her legs until they were no longer touching his. Look, Ron, about what happened between us. What happened? He interrupted. You make it sound like a car accident. He put his hand on her leg. Some memories remain close. You can shut your eyes and find yourself back in them. These are first-person memories. I memories. But there are second-person memories, too. Distant you memories. And these are trickier. You watch yourself in disbelief, like the Much Ado rap party at the old playhouse in 1961 when you seduced Ron. Even recalling it is like watching a movie. You're up on screen doing these awful things and you can't quite believe it. This other Deborah, so flattered by his attention. Ron, the pipe-smoking actor who went to school in New York and acted off-Broadway. And you corner him at the rap party. Ramble on about your stupid ambition. I want to do it all, stage and film. You play it coquettish, then aggressive, then shy again, delivering your lines impeccably. Just one night. Almost as if testing the limits of your powers. But now, in the empty theater, she moved his hand. Ron, I'm married now. So when I'm married, it's okay, but your relationships are what, sacred? No, we're just older now. We should be smarter, right? He chewed his lip and stared at a point in the back of the theater. Dee, I don't mean this to sound harsh, but a 40-something-year-old drunk, a used car dealer, this is the love of your life? She flinched. Alvis had picked her up here twice after rehearsal, and both times he'd stopped for a couple of drinks first. She pressed on. Ron, if you cast me in this play because you think we have some unfinished business, all I can say is, we don't. That's over. We slept together, what, twice? You need to get past that if we're going to do this play together. Get past it? What do you think this play is about, Dee? It's Deborah. I go by Deborah now, not Dee. And the play is not about us, Ron. It's about Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe. He took his glasses off, put them back on, and then ran his hand through his hair. He drew a deep, meaningful breath. Actor tics, treating every moment not only as if it had been written for him, but as if it were the pivotal scene in the production of his life. Did it ever occur to you that maybe this is why you never made it as an actress? Because for the great ones, Dee, Deborah, it is about them. It's always about them. And the funny thing was, he was right. She knew. She had seen the great ones up close, and they lived like Cleopatra and Antony, like Caterina and Petruchio, as if the scene ended when they left it, the world stopped when they closed their eyes. You don't even see what you are, Ron said. You use people. You play with their lives and treat them like they're nothing. The words stung with familiarity, and Deborah could say nothing back. Then Ron turned and stormed back toward the stage, leaving Deborah sitting in the wooden theater seat alone. That's it for today, he yelled. She called home. The sitter, the neighbor girl, Emma, said that Pat had broken the knob off the television again. She could hear him banging on pots in the kitchen. Pat, I'm on the phone with your mom! The banging got louder. Where's his dad? Deborah asked. Emma said that Alvis had called from Bender Chevrolet and asked if she could babysit until 10 p.m., that he'd made dinner reservations after work, and that if Deborah called, she was supposed to meet him at Trader Vic's. Dee checked her watch. It was almost 7. What time did he call, Emma? About 4. 3 hours? He could be at least 6 cocktails in. 4 if he didn't go straight to the bar. Even for Alvis, that was some head start. Thanks, Emma. We'll be home soon. Mrs. Bender? Last time you guys got home after midnight, and I had school the next day? I know, Emma. I'm sorry. I promise we'll be home earlier this time. Deborah hung up, put her coat on, and stepped out into the cool Seattle air, a light rain seeming to come off the sidewalk. Ron's car was still in the parking lot, and she hurried to her Corvair, climbed in, and turned the key. Nothing. She tried again. Still, nothing. The first 2 years of their marriage, Alvis had got her a new Chevy from his dealership every 6 months. This year, though, she'd said it was unnecessary. She'd just keep the Corvair. And now it had some kind of starter problem, of course. She thought about calling Trader Vic's, but it was only 10 or 12 blocks, almost a straight shot down 5th. She could take the monorail. But when she got outside, she decided to walk instead. Alvis would be angry. One thing he hated about Seattle was its scummy downtown, a bit of which she'd have to walk through. But she thought a walk might clear her mind after that awful business with Ron. She walked briskly, her umbrella pointed forward into the stinging mist. As she walked, she imagined all the things she should have said to Ron. Yes, Alvis is the love of my life. She replayed his cutting words. You use people. Treat them like they're nothing. She'd used similar words on her first date with Alvis to describe the film business. She'd returned to Seattle to find it a different city, buzzing with promise. It had seemed so small to her before, but maybe she had been shrunk by all that happened in Italy, returning beaten to a city that basked in the glow of the World's Fair. Even her old theater chums enjoyed a new playhouse on the fairgrounds. Dee stayed away from the fair, and from the theater, the way she avoided seeing Cleopatra when it came out, reading and reveling a little shamefully in its bad reviews. She moved in with her sister to lick her wounds, as Darlene aptly described it. Dee assumed she'd give the baby up for adoption, but Darlene talked her into keeping it. Dee told her family that the baby's father was an Italian innkeeper, and it was that lie that gave her the idea to name the baby after Pasquale. When Pat was 3 months old, Deborah went back to work at Frederick and Nelson in the men's grill, and she was filling a customer's ginger ale when she looked up one day to see a familiar man. Tall, thin and handsome, a slight stoop to his shoulders, a burst of gray at his temples. It took a minute to recognize him. Alvis Bender, Pasquale's friend. "Di More," he said. "Your mustache is gone," she said. And then, "It's Deborah now. Deborah Moore."
"I'm sorry, Deborah," Alvis said and sat down at the counter.
He told her that his father was looking at buying a car dealership in Seattle and he'd sent Alvis out west to scout it. It was strange bumping into Alvis in Seattle. Italy now seemed like a kind of interrupted dream for her. To see someone from that time was like déjà vu, like encountering a fictional character on the street. But he was charming and easy to talk to, and she found it a relief to be with someone who knew her whole story. She realized that lying to everyone about what had happened had been like holding her breath for the last year. They had dinner, drinks. Alvis was funny, and she felt comfortable immediately with him. His father's car dealerships were thriving, and that was nice too, being with a man who could clearly take care of himself. He kissed her cheek at the door to her apartment. The next day, Alvis came by the lunch counter again, and said that he needed to admit something. It was no accident that he'd found her. She'd told him about herself in those last days in Italy. They had taken a boat together to La Spezia, and he'd accompanied her on the train to the Rome airport, and that she figured she'd go back to Seattle. "To do what?" Alvis had asked. She'd shrugged and said that she used to get work at a big Seattle department store. Thought maybe she'd go back. So when his father mentioned that he was looking at a Seattle Chevy dealership, Alvis jumped at the chance to find her. He'd tried other department stores, the Bon Marché and Roads of Seattle, before someone at the perfume counter at Frederick and Nelson said there was a tall blonde girl named Deborah who used to be an actress.
"So, you came all the way to Seattle just to find me?"
"We are looking at a dealership here, but yes, I was hoping to see you."
He looked around the lunch counter.
"Do you remember in Italy, you said you liked my book, and I said I was having trouble finishing it? Do you remember what you said? Maybe it's finished. Maybe that's all there is."
"Oh, I wasn't saying..."
"No, no," he interrupted her. "It's okay. I hadn't written anything new in 5 years anyway. I just kept rewriting the same chapter. But you saying that, it was like giving me permission to admit that it's all I had to say. That one chapter, and to go on with my life."
He smiled.
"I didn't go back to Italy this year. I think I'm done with all that. I'm ready to do something else."
Something in the way he said those words, "ready to do something else," struck her as intimately familiar. She had said the same thing to herself. "What are you going to do?"
"Well," he said, "that's what I wanted to talk to you about. What I would really like to do more than anything is go hear some jazz."
She smiled. "Jazz?"
"Yes," he said. The concierge at his hotel had mentioned a club on Cherry Street at the foot of the hill.
"The penthouse," she said.
He tapped his nose charade style.
That's the place.
She laughed. Are you asking me out, Mr. Bender? He gave that sly half-smile.
That depends, Miss Moore, on your answer.
She took a deep, assessing look at him. Question mark posture, thin features, modish swoop of graying brown hair, and thought, sure, why not? There you go, Ron. There's the love of her life. Now a block from Trader Vic's, she saw Alvis's Biscayne, parked with one tire partly on the curb. Had he been drinking at work? She looked inside the car, but except for a barely smoked cigarette in the ashtray, there was no evidence that this had been one of his binge days. She walked into Trader Vic's, into a burst of warm air and bamboo, tiki and totem, dugout canoe hung from the ceiling. She looked around the thatch-matted room for him, but the tables were packed with chattering couples and big round chairs, and she couldn't see him anywhere. After a minute, the manager, Harry Wong, was at her arm with a Mai Tai.
I think you need to catch up.
He pointed her to a table in the back, and there she saw Alvis, a big wicker chair back surrounding his head like a Renaissance halo. He was doing what Alvis did best, drinking and talking, lecturing some poor waiter who was doing everything he could to edge away. But Alvis had landed one of his big hands on the waiter's arm, and the poor kid was stuck. She took the drink from Harry Wong. Thanks for keeping him upright for me, Harry. She tilted the glass, and the sweet liqueur and rum hit her throat, and Deborah surprised herself by drinking half of it. She stared at the drink through eyes that had become bleary with tears. One day when she was in high school, someone had slipped a note into her locker that read, "You whore." All that day she'd been pissed off until she got home that night and saw her mother, at which point she inexplicably broke into tears. It was how she felt now. The sight of Alvis, even drunk Dr. Alvis, his lecturing alter ego, enough to break her up. She carefully dabbed her eyes, put the glass to her lips, and finished it. Then she gave the dead soldier to Harry. Harry, could you bring us some water and maybe some food for Mr. Bender? Harry nodded. She walked through the chattering crowd, catching eyes throughout the room, and picked up her husband's lecture.
Bobby can beat LBJ, right at its apex. And I'd argue that the only significant accomplishment of the Kennedy administration, integration, actually belongs to Bobby anyway. And would you look at this woman?
Alvis was beaming at her, his rummy eyes seeming to melt at the corners. His arm freed, the waiter made his escape, nodding his thanks to Deborah for her timely arrival. Alvis stood like a parasol opening. He pulled out her chair, ever the gentleman.
Every time I see you, I lose my breath.
She sat. I guess I forgot that we were going out tonight.
We always go out on Fridays.
It's Thursday, Alvis.
You are so tied to routine.
Harry brought them each a tall glass of water and a plate of egg rolls. Alvis sipped his water.
This is the worst martini I've ever had, Harry.
Lady's orders, Alvis. Deborah freed the cigarette from Alvis's hand and replaced it with an egg roll, which Alvis pretended to smoke.
Smooth, he said.
Deborah took a long draw of his cigarette. As he ate the egg roll, Alvis said through his nose,
And how are things in the theater, darling?
Ron's driving me crazy.
Ah, the frisky director. Shall I dust your ass for fingerprints?
His joke masked the slightest insecurity, a pretense of faux jealousy. She was glad for both, his twinge of jealousy and the way he joked it away. That's what she should have told Ron, that her husband was a man who had outgrown such petty, insecure games. She told Alvis about Ron constantly interrupting her, pushing her to play Maggie like some kind of caricature, breathy and stupid, like a Marilyn impersonation. I should never have done this, she said, and she planted the cigarette purposely in the ashtray, bending the butt like a knee joint.
Ah, come on.
He lit another cigarette.